You're listening to WAMU 88.5.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the Current newspapers. Tom, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Great Friday afternoon. I'll be visiting the cherry blossoms this afternoon.
It's a great Friday afternoon for a lot of people, but I suspect it's not a great Friday afternoon for the family of Medrick Cecil Mills, because it turns out that Lieutenant Colleen Davis, who has been working in the Department of Fire and Emergency Medical Services for more than 25 years and who is the one who was in charge at the fire station on Rhode Island Avenue the day that Mr. Mills had his heart attack and died, who was before a disciplinary panel recently, but before that disciplinary panel could reach a conclusion and tell the fire chief about it, somehow or the other, by the mystery of the regulations of employment in that department, Colleen Davis has been retired. She is retired and now gets 70% of her $100,000 a year salary, and the Mills family is quite upset about that, as I'm sure are a lot of other people.
You know, it is in the government, when people get into trouble, oftentimes they retire before the disciplinary, cumbersome disciplinary process could go forward. I think it's bad. I mean, with all the attention that the mayor has said he was giving this, with all the attention that Chief Ellerby has said he was giving this, for all the attention that Deputy Mayor Paul Quander has said he was giving this, it seems like they could have slowed this process down and held it up. I do believe they have the authority to do that. It will only add to the suspicion that the fire department is not run for the people that this has occurred, whether it's true or not.
Does this mean this is the end of this, that even when we discover what the panel that held the disciplinary hearing has decided on, that becomes irrelevant because Lieutenant Davis has retired and therefore this matter ends? Or
I think there's a danger that the trial board can decide, okay, well, there's nothing before us, the issue is moot because the person has retired, but there are other people who are involved too. So those are continuing. I did hear Mark Seagrave from NBC4 asking the chief's office if the reports would still be coming out, if the board would be going forward. And I got the impression that yes, but I didn't hear it directly. But it would only compound the bad image of the city if somehow another, the retirement of one person in this swept the rest of it away from our a public report.
There has been such a great deal of public outrage about this that even if at a formal level proceedings may have come to an end, I don't think we've heard the end of this because people are going to continue.
Well, I think you'll hear from the council members and from the candidates for mayor, and about, you know, neither the two principal candidates for mayor, Muriel Bowser or David Catania, has said that they would keep Chief Ellerby there. In fact, David Catania has said that Chief Ellerby ought to step down. So I think the fire department will be a focus in the election, just as education is going to be.
Speaking of council members, Ward 3 council member Mary Shea is seeking to abolish the D.C. Taxi Cab Commission and take some of the responsibilities away from the District Department of Transportation. Exactly what is she trying to do here?
It's a pretty sweeping shakeup of the transit issues in the District of Columbia. One of the big ones for people who are listening who don't live in the city or anyone who drives in the city, she wants to clarify the parking ticket situation. You know, right now, the DDOT is responsible for the meters out on the street.
She would create a department of parking management.
Right. And it will simplify who's responsible for the meters. And also, if you get a ticket, what do you do? I mean, one agency adjudicates the ticket. I love that word, adjudicates. handles the ticket. And another agency gives them out. So it's the main thing to know This is a proposal that even she says is just the beginning of a proposal, that she's not sure how it's all going to shake out, but she thinks that DDOT ought to focus on the roads, Department of Motor Vehicles and Transit and those kinds of issues.
And she'll abolish the taxi cab commission
altogether.
Taxi cab
commission, many people have said they want to abolish the taxi commission. There's no need to appoint all the people to sit around and talk about taxi cab policy.
So there will be something instead called a district transit authority.
And we had streetcars and connections with Metro. There's a lot of interworking parts here. She thinks that the jumble of agencies ought to be clarified.
And before we go to our guest at hand, for whom there are a lot of people who, to whom a lot of people would like to talk, who is not running in the at-large race in the upcoming mayor and the upcoming election in November? Because it now appears as if Ward 6 Councilmember Tommy Wells, who lost in the primary for mayor, Ward 7 Councilmember Yvette Alexander apparently is considering it. The well-known Alyssa Silverman, Reverend Graylin Hagler seems to be considering it. Anyone else?
That's a pretty good list, but, you know, I haven't checked my inbox in the last 5 minutes, so could be others. You know, I don't think of Yvette Alexander. I mean, there was this great conspiracy theme going on that she was going to run at large so that there would be an opening in Ward 7, that Mayor Gray could then run for that seat when the special election were to occur next year, or that Mayor Gray would somehow or another be in position to run in 2016 against Vincent Orange. It's just too complicated.
It's too jumbled right
now.
You
think people have enough to do without creating these scenarios?
Just creating,
but this
confusion
is a good opportunity. David Catania, you know, the mayor's Muriel Bowser's people have been saying, "Oh, David Catania is not going to really get into the race. He's got until June to really get into the race. He's going to stay and he's going to run for re-election. He's not a serious candidate for mayor." He says that to him is wishful thinking. He is giving up his seat, and so that's why the seat's available. There are discussions of maybe a slate being put together. Tommy Wells has talked. People have talked to him about running this time or running against Vincent Orange 2 years from now.
A lot of turmoil going on, and we can't make any real sense of it right now, but as soon as we can, we'll be sure to let you know. Joining us now in studio is Abigail Smith. She is the Deputy Mayor for Education of the District of Columbia. Abby Smith, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Coach.
You're not running, right?
I am definitely not running. You heard it here first.
For the time being, anyway. The last time we talked, about 2 weeks ago, about this year's school choice lottery. Since then, you've floated three different proposals for redrawing school boundaries in the district, and we'll get to what each of those plans calls for in just a second. But first, I'd like to get your sense for the sensitivity of this issue. The city paper described each of the plans on a scale of who they freaked out and who they made happy. A lot of people have bought homes based on the current boundaries. What sense do you have for the landmines that might be in front of you in this process, and why do you feel it's so necessary to press forward?
So, Kojo, you're right that this is a very sensitive issue, and student assignment, where your kid goes to school, is something that is really personal for families, affects lots of different things about their kid's experience and their own logistics and experience as a family. So it is certainly something that's very close to home for families, and therefore people are very interested. I will say that I have been really pleased, appreciative of the degree of engagement that people have committed to this process. So we had, over the last week, we've had three community meetings at three different high schools in D.C., and across them, about 500 people have showed up just during this part of the process. We're about halfway through a process that started in October, so there's still a lot of discussion to be had, and I think it's a really good sign that so many people are paying attention, are interested, want to provide feedback and help us figure out how to do this right.
This is a simple question. What are you trying to do? Why are the boundaries, even though they haven't been changed in 40 years, why is it so important to change the boundaries? What are you trying to do?
So there are a couple things, Tom. So one, as you note, it's been a very long time since there's been a comprehensive revision of the boundaries. So 1968 is the last time that the city did this in a comprehensive way. And since that time, there have been lots and lots of changes in the city demographically, in terms of population of kids, of school-age kids, and also lots of changes in school supply. So a lot of schools that have closed, schools that have opened, schools that have moved. And as a result, our current tangle of boundaries and feeder patterns patterns is just not workable for a lot of families, creates lots of confusion in the process. And we've got schools that are overcrowded, kids who don't have access to the schools that are right near them because of closed schools and changes that in boundaries that have just been sort of stuck together over the years.
If you have questions or comments for Abigail Smith, give us a call at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Can we go through as quickly as possible the proposals one by one? So-called Proposal A seems to be the one that differs the most from the current system. What does that call for?
So let me just say a little bit about the proposals, Kojo. So what we have done as an advisory committee, which is the group that's been shepherding this process throughout, is we've looked at a whole range of how one might approach student assignment. And there are lots of different elements that can be part of an overall student assignment policy. So the advisory committee looked at many of those different elements and put together what we're terming three policy examples of how you could put those elements together in a coherent policy so that the community could understand what that might look like from pre-K to 12 and understand it all together. That said, our expectation is that we're not choosing among policy example A, B, and C. We wanted to provide three examples so people can see how these things fit together, but we imagine that we will probably end up with example D, E, F, or X, Y, Z once people figure out what pieces of this seem workable to them, seem like they resolve some of the challenges that we have.
It seems, in the most fundamental way, that parents, people who have children in schools, whether they're just starting or in middle school going forward, want a simple system. They want to go to an elementary school in their neighborhood. They want to go into a middle school, which they recognize can't be as close as elementary school because they're larger. And the same with the high school. And I've talked to parents who are just like horrified that their students getting to high school may not be able to go to the school most convenient for them, that they'll have to travel across town. They'll spend hours traveling around. Why not make the schools better rather than changing the boundaries?
So you brought up a number of things in that, Tom. I've certainly been hearing those things from the community. So one is this notion of predictability. And it is true that predictability is really important to families, knowing that knowing what they can expect in terms of where their kids are going to go for elementary, middle, and high school. At the same time, families want to ensure that they have access to high quality schools. And you know, you touched on the piece around how can we ensure that we're improving schools and ensuring that they're all high quality. That work of improving schools is the daily work of schools right now. DCPS is working hard to do that at the school level. Communities are supporting that. The DCPS central office and under the chancellor's leadership is working to do that. In the meantime, families want to know that they can have access to high quality schools. And for some families, they feel like they've got that right now, and some families don't. And so while that predictability and proximity to home is certainly a value that many people share, it in some cases is in conflict with ensuring that there's some access to schools that may not be your neighborhood schools if you're not right now confident in those schools.
Yeah, I just talked to parents, and I know parents go to out-of-boundary schools, and they work hard to get their children from one to, and let's just say it, to get into Alice Deal and Wilson High School. But they say the reason they do that, because they go to those extraordinary lengths, is because they do not have the same opportunities in the middle schools in the other parts of the city, maybe Capitol Hill the exception, or across the river, east end of the city. And I'm just wondering, I don't understand why they can't be, these are not more in tandem, that you make all the spend more money. The weighted school formula could be changed so that schools will get more money based on the socioeconomic conditions of the schools where they are, where they have more staff, more everything to make those schools function rather than making the parents move their kids across town to go to what you call a quality school.
So you're absolutely right.
Why that takes a long time.
So if I had a magic wand and could wave it and make sure that all of our schools were at a quality today that every single parent would be thrilled at, I would have used that magic wand. And
what's
so would you have.
What's keeping
I think
from,
that
is
there's,
it money?
So
is
there,
it
there,
this
is,
time?
There is a lot of work that's happening right now, and we've seen lots of improvements in our school system across the city and in individual schools. The piece that you talked about resources, is something that we are really focused on. And one of the things that's in the new student formula that we have just rolled out for the upcoming fiscal year is an at-risk weight that does target additional dollars to schools that are serving really high-need kids. So those are things that are underway. There are lots of improvements at all of our schools, elementary, middle, and high. At the same time, as that work is ongoing, we want to make sure that our student assignment system is both workable for families, and again,
when
there's some practical issues, but also fair.
A magic wand. What you're saying, what I am hearing, it might not be what you're saying, it's certainly what I'm hearing, is that improving a school is not as simple as throwing money at the school, and that improving a school is not necessarily as rapid as some of us may want it to happen.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we certainly see that change can happen, and we want that change to be faster and faster, but we know that it can't happen overnight.
But I don't think throwing money at schools, if I don't mean to suggest that, but I'm thinking in a school that doesn't have a librarian, it's not throwing money at a school to have a full-time librarian on the staff, as opposed to having a librarian who trundles around like some itinerant preacher from school to school. It's not throwing money at the schools to have a physical education teacher or coach in a school where children need more exercise. It's not throwing money at schools to put resources in the schools. I just don't understand why it cannot be done.
Well, you're absolutely right, and that's why every DCPS elementary and middle school does have that art and music and PE and librarian that you talked about. That's a standard that DCPS has put in place.
Weren't the librarians cut? I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but weren't the librarians cut back?
Well, librarians actually were added to schools this last year. And it is true that not every school has a full time of each of those positions, in depending upon the enrollment of the school.
If you have a full time librarian, since reading is fundamental, and you have those, then the people would come to the schools. They don't come to the schools because they don't offer the resources that you can get at Alice Deal.
I think that you will see that across all of DCPS's schools, there's a certain baseline expectation of what is offered that includes those things. You're right that Alice Deal, with 1,000 kids, can provide more diversity of programming than a middle school that has 200 kids. And so that's one of the challenges and one of the things that we're looking at in terms of the student assignment policy. How do we ensure that we can support all of our schools with the kinds of programming that they need?
On to the telephones. Don your headphones, please, because Mark in Washington, D.C. would like to have words with you. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the show. I have been listening to the comments. I also attended the event at Coolidge, and definitely a supporter of most of the elements of Plan B. I guess one of the things that a lot of parents that I've been talking to is the sense of urgency, and I still don't have a lot of clarity as to why it has to be inside of this timeline. And I don't think anybody questions that the system could be improved, but there are things that are working very well currently in some of the schools that will be affected. And also to see or to understand why there's not more of a comprehensive view of this reform that touches the Office of Planning, the Department of Transportation, because so much of this, in terms of the quality of school, isn't just about the schools. And so if you could speak to why it needs to be done so quickly. And it doesn't seem to be involving parents' input to this.
Thanks, Mark. So one, glad that you were at the event at Coolidge and hope that you will continue to engage in this process. I would say a couple things about the timeline. One is that while it might seem like this is all of a sudden to folks, the fact that we haven't done this in a comprehensive way since 1968 tells me that we haven't rushed this at some level. So it is time to look at these issues. And we have what is a year-long process that we're engaged in. So we're about halfway through that. We've had a lot of parent engagement to this point, and I know we'll have lots more as we have more concrete proposals on the table that people have a chance to react to. So to this point, over 1,000 folks have come to community meetings over the last few months, which is great. In terms of how we think about how this intersects with other parts of city planning, I think you raise a really good point. We have members from the Office of Planning on our our advisory group. And in fact, Ellen McCarthy, who was just named as the new director of the Office of Planning, was already sitting on our advisory group as a community member, so has all of that context already of the work that we're doing as she's going into that role as Office of Planning, because we do need to connect all of those things.
Thank you very much for your call. We never got to talk really about what these examples, as you call them, A, B, and C, called for. Is there any way you can give us a synopsis of that?
Sure.
Quickly?
So all of the policy examples at elementary have some kind of established boundary for elementary schools. So two of the policies have a very traditional one-to-one. So you have an elementary school that's assigned to you by virtue of where you live, which is what most kids have now in D.C., although because of closures, some kids have right to multiple elementary schools. Policy example A thinks about that boundary as a somewhat larger boundary. So it's still based geographically, but there'd be multiple schools within that boundary. And what we call a choice set. So you'd have the opportunity to choose among those. The things that I think are, Mark talked about policy example B, which I think is appealing to a lot of people. It has a boundary and feeder system that has that one-to-one relationship between elementary, middle, and high for each kid, so you'd have a right to one school, and then builds feeder patterns that align with that. Right now, our feeder patterns actually bear only passing connection to the boundaries. So there are lots of situations where an elementary school might be outside of the boundary of the middle school that it feeds into currently. Mm-hmm. This would align those boundaries and feeder patterns so that there would be a more cohesive connection. And then C, both A and C at the high school level include some form of broader citywide high school choice. So in one scenario, in example A, it's high school choice, but with a proximity preference. So you'd have a preference for the high school that's closest to you, but kids would have the opportunity to access schools across the city. Whereas policy example C actually has just citywide high school choice and would not have a proximity preference.
What do you mean by choice? Choice sounds like, oh, good, I get to decide. But one of these, I've forgotten, these A, B, and C, in the high schools, would be all students going into high school would just be simply into a lottery. Where it's, so if I live near Wilson High School, across the street from Wilson, under one of these scenarios, I might get Roosevelt, or I might get Cardozo, or I might get some other school, right? How does that student get there?
In terms of transportation?
That doesn't sound like choice to me. That sounds like a luck of the draw.
So
I think choice is the wrong word that you guys use.
So I understand that point, and I think that choice can be a problematic word for people because it feels like you get to pick, and in some cases,
yeah. I know what choice means.
Yep. So I understand that sort of nomenclature issue. The notion is that for the citywide high school scenario is that students would be able to say, all right, given my preferences, including, you know, potentially the geographic preferences, but also the kinds of programming that's offered, if they're specialized programs at schools, they would rank the schools that they want to attend. And it is true that if everybody wanted to attend one school and that school was out of capacity, then you would go down to the next one on your list.
What parent in Shepherd Park, Northwest Washington, off of 16th Street, is going to have his child or her child say, okay, I want to go to Ballou, only because of the distance to Ballou in far southeast Washington, Ward 8? Who's going to write that as their choice?
So obviously I can't answer that question without asking all them. I think that that what we see is that kids already are traveling a lot at high school, and we have, in fact, I mean, even if you look at Wilson right now, where the boundary is, as you know, almost half of the city's landmass, so it's a very large boundary, and you still have about 40% of kids who are coming from out of that boundary. There are certainly lots of kids who are out of boundary in other schools too, in part because of the sort of what I talked about, the sort of confusing mix of feeders and boundaries, but in part because kids are choosing different schools.
I think I respect what you're trying to do, but I think there's almost a fantasy element to part of this, glossing over what parents will actually do with their children.
But here's Dita in Washington, D.C. Dita, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks, and thanks to Deputy Mayor Smith for being on to be able to get this feedback today. So I'm a parent. I'm outside on my lunch hour right now, working mom with kids in public school in Washington, D.C. And a couple of things. One quick question is, why were the meetings not open? Because it feels like there's just this huge data dump and you're saying this has been going on for a while, but, you know, there's a lot of parent engagement right now because we're all saying, where on earth did this come from? And the meeting I went to, and a lot of chatter in my school is, you know, parents talk about the predictability, but there's this issue of, you know, people wanting to know, you know, not just like, are my kids going to get to stay in their school and go to, you know, the feeder and pattern to the other schools, but it's like, what about the kids behind me? But then I've been hearing people talk about, oh, grandfather clause. And I just find it ironic that you're having this discussion today when it's 50-year signing of the Civil Rights Act. And we talk about grandfathering, that's from Jim Crow laws to, you know, ensure black voter suppression. And it's like this whole issue in this school set that we want quality schools for every child, but please do not break what's working to fix what's broken.
Abby Smith.
So in terms of the process, I know that a lot of people are engaging in this sort of for the first time now as we have lots more information out there. The reality is we've also had lots of engagement with community over the last number of months in terms of where we've been all along this process. So I know it does feel like we've dumped a lot of information on people. One of the things that I said at this last round of community meetings to everyone is we're giving you too much information right now for any one person to digest in a 3-hour community meeting, which is what we had over this last week. But we would rather give people more information and have everyone have access to the same kinds of data and policy ideas that the advisory committee is wrestling with than to hold anything back. So it is a lot right now, and this is the time for us to all wrestle with it together. I know there are a lot of things that people have had very strong reactions to, and what I keep emphasizing with everyone is these are proposals that we think that we as a community need to talk about together, and we could come out with one final, refined, shiny proposal and see people's reactions to it. We think we're going to get a much better result if we bring out a number of different
ideas.
Allow
me to have a caller who has a specific question about this. Ellen in Washington, D.C. Ellen, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo and Abigail. I'm a mom on Capitol Hill, and I'm in a neighborhood where under choice A, in its current iteration at any rate, you've paired a couple of schools where the average test scores are more than 20 points apart. So, I mean, this is Maury and Payne and Brent and Tyler. My question is, do you really expect parents who would be pushed from a higher performing school, significantly higher, to a lower performing one to actually go? I picture these folks going charter, going to independence, going to the burbs, at least in the upper elementary grades, because these are middle class families who can and will vote with their feet. So I'd just like you to talk a little bit about that
Abby
arrangement
Smith.
And why you've proposed it.
So, Ellen, you're raising, again, a point that certainly a lot of folks have raised, and we think this is really important feedback, trying to understand what parents are interested in and what they think they'd be willing to do. One of the things that the choice sets does allow is some more ability to for families to access some of the specialized programming that exists in certain parts of the city. So in the choice set that you just talked about, Tyler Elementary, for example, has a dual language program that is very popular. And one of the things that makes the choice set's interesting to some folks is that it allows more access to those kinds of programs for people who live nearby. So rather than having to sort of throw in with everyone else to sort of go across the city to a program like that, you would have an increased ability to stay closer to home. That said, people have raised the concerns that you've raised on the choice sets, and that's exactly why we're having these conversations.
Muriel Bowser, the Democratic candidate for mayor, has said, has kind of taken two different views of this. On the one hand, she says she thinks she can support choice sets. On the other hand, she wants more predictability. A parent who's not sure where his or her child is going to go is not going to have that kind of predictability. So we'll still in the campaign figure out more about what would-be Mayor Bowser wants. David Catania has been a little firmer about this. He says that you ought to push the pause button and delay this while you're working. All the work you're doing to improve the schools is more important, he says, than making those artificial boundary changes, because there's so much out-of-boundary charter schools and all of that. He says the focus ought to be on changing the schools, not changing the boundaries, and push the pause button. Comment on either one of those positions?
I
know I'm trying to draw you into the mayor's race, but, you know, it may be the most significant issue in this, assuming that they ever get together to debate.
Well, first of all, I appreciate that both Councilmember Bowser and Councilmember Catania are engaging this process. We welcome their feedback as everybody else's. I think that recognizing that you know, they're both pointing out some of the challenges and tensions that we have. So there
and
they're
is inconsistencies.
There's an inherent tension in some ways between predictability and access to high quality schools. And for some families who right now, everybody has predictability right now, but not everybody's happy with the predictability that they have a guarantee to. And so I think we just have to recognize that that's a reality. Now, I know that a couple of callers have talked about let's not mess with something that's working. And I think that's a very, very real issue that for families who are happy with the system, clearly, they don't want that change, and I understand that. And we don't want to make things more difficult for families who currently are happy with what they've got.
I think that's the kind of the fundamental concern which people are expressing. There are people happy with the situation they have, but then you acknowledge, and what people know, there are many schools and many parents where people aren't happy. But is the answer then is to take the average and make it? People are concerned that they say to me that you're, why don't you just bus kids to school and change the school system around just to do busing? Of course, busing, I say that somewhat facetiously because busing was so controversial. But if you're trying to get a socioeconomic mix and change things around, why not just do it more directly?
Well, there are lots of different ways that we have right now in our system to allow access through out of boundaries you talked about, through feeder rights that we have. I think that it is the right thing for us to do as a community to step back and have the conversation, are we doing this as well as we can? And these are really hard conversations because they do involve, and I put this out here again and again in my conversations, they involve issues of race and class, they involve issues of people who can afford to ensure that their predictability is something they like by virtue of where they live. And I think we can't shy away from having this conversation as a city.
So may I just say, follow up that sentence? Mm-hmm. So are you trying to reach some kind of socioeconomic balance?
I'm trying to ensure that we as a community are involved together in a conversation around what our student assignment policies are. There's some practical considerations that we have to address. But I think at the same time, it's an opportunity to think about how this can be connected to a fair system and a system that supports quality for everybody.
My experience has been that parents do not accept the rationale that we will be improving this school. So is this proposal intended to make available more seats in quality schools as soon as possible?
So some of the things that have come out of this proposal are focused on exactly that point, Kojo. So there are a couple of specific ideas that have emerged that I think have gotten some traction for certain communities. One is this conversation about a selective middle school, particularly placing it east of the river, and to provide opportunity for families that are looking for that level of rigor to have a selective option at the middle school, which we don't have anywhere in the city now. Another is looking at whether there are magnet programs that can be in comprehensive high schools. So they still would be comprehensive high schools in that case and neighborhood schools, but you'd have an opportunity to have some kind of specialized programming. So those are some things I think that have been part of the conversation that can help support this move towards quality.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Abigail Smith, this is clearly a continuing conversation, so I'll expect to be talking to you about it again sometime in the near future.
Thank you so much.
And can I just say, I respect the effort of trying to get the schools to be something that every parent wants to send his or her child to. It just seems to me that we're playing Chinese checkers when we should be playing checkers.
What exactly would that mean?
It would simplify the system a lot more than the...
I was pretty good at Chinese checkers.
Well, I've heard the checkers and chess. I didn't know the Chinese checkers.
Well, I'm trying to keep it in the same words.
Abigail Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Abigail Smith is the Deputy Mayor for Education in the District of Columbia. Tom, what is going on in Arlington, Virginia, where for decades they've been electing exclusively Democrats to the Arlington County Council, but not so much this last go-around? And I don't know if I'm pronouncing this name correctly, but it's John Vistad, a Republican who was running as an independent, upset Democrat Alan Housie in a low turnout race for the Arlington County Board. It looks as if the Arlington County voters were sending a message here that one-party rule, as it exists to a large extent, both in the District of Columbia and in Maryland, is not going to be working here in Arlington County
anymore. Well, I think the larger message that was sent is that people didn't vote. It was a special election just to finish out the term of Chris Zimmerman. 16% of the people voted. 16%. That made us look pretty good in the district with our
23%.
And the Democrat Alan House has a really strong record in the county, and many people thought he would win because he is a Democrat. And but John Vestad said there's the $1 million bus stop and the streetcar line. There's just lots of issues, but I think this election is going to be replayed again in November. So I don't think we should draw a great moment from the outcome of this election until we see if it can be replicated in November.
Joining us in studio now is Brian Frush. He is a member of the Maryland Senate, a Democrat from Montgomery County. He's also a Democratic candidate for Attorney General of Maryland. Senator Frush, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks for having me.
If you have comments or questions for Brian Frush, give us a call at 800-433-8850, or you can send email to kojo@wamu.org. A lot happened in Annapolis this year. A lot more will be happening for you in the weeks ahead as things get more intense
in
your primary for Attorney General. But let's focus for a second on the General Assembly first. This was Martin O'Malley's last session as governor. What do you make of what you accomplished in Annapolis this year, and how would you describe the legacy that O'Malley might be leaving behind as mayor?
Well, we did some very good stuff this session. A lot of it, I chair the Judicial Proceedings Committee, a lot of it came through there. We passed some important domestic violence legislation. I was the sponsor, and it gives greater protections to victims of domestic violence. I had dinner last summer with a judge from the Superior Court in D.C., and she said to me, "What's up with Maryland? I keep getting women who have fled from Maryland to D.C. because they can't get the kind of protection they need in Maryland. Our standard for giving someone a final protective order was too high. We required clear and convincing evidence to prove it. No other state in the country does. We've lowered that standard to preponderance of the evidence, the normal civil standard, and it will mean much greater protection for victims of domestic violence."
And when will that go into effect?
It goes into effect, I think, June 1st. The governor has to sign it, but it goes into effect June 1st.
Well, can I just go right to politics?
Go right to
politics. You're running for attorney general.
Yes.
The attorney general current, Mr. Gansler, is running for governor. Have you picked sides in the governor's race?
No.
No,
I won't. The attorney general really ought to be independent. The attorney general needs to be able to say no to the governor. And Steve Sachs, who was first elected attorney general in 1978, was the first person in the 20th century not to run on a ticket with a gubernatorial candidate. I think that's the right policy decision, and so I'm going to run independently and will serve independently.
So it's not any characterization of the two candidates?
No.
Lieutenant Governor Brown or Doug Gansler?
No. Nor Heather Mazur.
Well, let me get back to the Attorney General race now before we talk more about what happened in the Senate. What would you say are the central differences between you and the other Democratic candidates looking for the party's nomination in this primary for Attorney General?
Well, I think people need to look at our records. The Attorney General is someone who needs experience, skill, and judgment to run the biggest law firm in the state, be the people's lawyer.
I should mention that you're facing two opponents in the primary, Delegate Aisha Braveboy.
Correct.
And
of Prince George's County.
Of Prince George's County, and Delegate John Cardin of Baltimore County. Go ahead.
That's right. And if you look at what we've accomplished in the General Assembly, if you look at what we've accomplished as attorneys, because it's important to have a skilled attorney, an attorney with judgment, run the biggest law firm in the state. I've got a record of fighting against gun violence. I was the architect of the Firearm Safety Act that passed last year, the toughest in the nation law. Numerous environmental initiatives, the Maryland Recycling Act, the law that stopped the oil companies from drilling for oil and gas in the bay, many legislative accomplishments that I think set me apart from both of them. And also, I've been in the private practice of law for more than 35 years. I was today elected to the American Law Institute, which the other member from Maryland who was elected today was the chief judge of our Court of Appeals, Mary Ellen Barbera. So I've been recognized as an accomplished attorney. So I think
you've acknowledged the challenges thus far of running against someone with such a big name as Ben Cardin in Maryland politics.
Well, it's his nephew. It's not Ben Cardin that I'm running against.
You're running against John Cardin.
Right.
See, that's the mistake that I just made is the mistake. Yeah,
that's what he's
potential
worried about people doing on the
exactly.
ballot.
Exactly
that's exactly right.
Probably make it. How are you going to go about introducing yourself to people outside of those who know you in your district and make a case against a person who is, at the very least, related to
right.
one of the more popular names in Maryland politics?
Well, none of the offices in Maryland are hereditary. But if in each case where folks have heard us and heard us make our cases, they've selected me. Just this week, the Columbia Democratic Club in Howard County voted to endorse me, and I had more than eight times as many votes as Delegate Cardin. Same with the Young Democrats. I only had a four times advantage in that one. But the AFL-CIO, AFSCME, the Maryland League of Conservation Voters, the Sierra Club, the National Organization for Women, and many other organizations, every major organization that has let us make our cases to them has endorsed me.
It sounds like, Anthony Brown, you've got more money, you've got more endorsements.
I'm hoping that'll be the path to victory.
800-433-8850 is the number to call. Our guest is Brian Frosch. He's a member of the Maryland Senate. He's a Democrat from Montgomery County. He's also a Democratic candidate for Attorney General. If you'd like to ask him about the last session of the General Assembly, feel free to do so. Or if you want to ask him political questions about his candidacy, Tom Sherman.
I'll ask one that fits both of those. And that's the minimum wage. Everyone, the governor on down, is breaking their arms, patting themselves on the back for raising the minimum wage to $10.10 by the year 2018.
Yes.
And it seemed to me that is the slowest approach in the country. I know in the district in Prince George's and I think
Montgomery County.
It's I know the district is 1150 by 2016, I believe. I don't quite know why the Democrats in Maryland are congratulating themselves for such a slow walk to a decent minimum wage.
Well, I agree with you. The walk is too slow for me. I supported a much rapider phase-in. I support the 1150 that we did in Montgomery, that Montgomery County Council did. And that's disappointing, but we did make progress. And anybody who works 40 hours a week ought to have enough to live on. You can't do that with the minimum wage as it is. So at least we're moving it up.
Within this listening audience, it's pretty good. When will the voters get to go to a forum where you and Brave Boy and Cardin might appear at the same time? Do you have one on your calendar, or how could we find out? If we go to your website, or is there some place where we can find out where these forums are?
Yes, you can go to brianfrosch.com. You can find out where we're appearing together. You can find out where I'm going.
And are you encouraging forums? And we're having an issue here in town about how many forums we might have for the mayor's race.
Yeah, we haven't. We've had a number, and we've got a bunch more scheduled.
Okay.
Where do you see things headed with marijuana in Maryland? The bill the governor has said he would sign decriminalizes possession of small amounts of marijuana. Your colleague, Mike Miller, said earlier this year that he sees legalization as inevitable. What do you see?
Well, I think that's I think Mike Miller is an historian, and I think if you put it in historical context, you can see us in the same place the country was in the few years before Prohibition ended in the United States. We're lucky in Maryland that we're going to be able to get to watch the laboratories in Colorado and Washington State, see how it works in those jurisdictions before we make that step.
And Mike Miller is not only a historian, he might also be a predictor of the future. He said, I know where people are going to be a generation or two from now.
Yeah.
There won't be a generation necessarily.
Exactly right. It might be a shorter time than that.
I think that's right. I mean, we took a very important step this year. The Judicial Proceedings Committee that I chair crafted the legislation. Bobby Zirkin from Baltimore County was the author. The Senate passed a bill last year, and it failed in the House, and it was exciting that it got through this year. But it's an important step forward. We arrest about 30,000 people a year for simple possession of small amounts of marijuana. And it's a waste of our resources, and it ruins lives. So,
is there any racial economic breakdown of the people who get arrested in the District of Columbia? You know, the young African-American males were being arrested far more, 90% of the cases, as opposed to the people out back of this building or something.
Yeah, it's 3-1. And 3-1 African-Americans getting arrested, and the use is demographically the same. I mean, the same proportion of people who are not African-American are smoking marijuana as those who are.
Don your headphones, please, because Laura in Silver Spring, Maryland has a question or comment for you. Laura, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Hello, Senator Frosch. I have a question about funding for Montgomery County school construction. The effort failed to pass in the last legislative session, and I would like to know what are the Maryland senators going to do about this for next year, because we are at, next year we'll be at 150% capacity at our elementary school. And within 2 years, we'll have 12 portables in the back of the school, and we'll have to have lunches from 10:30 in the morning all the way to 1:30 in the afternoon.
What have you
done? We need funds now.
What have you done for your county lately?
Yes, well, I mean,
school funding is a huge issue.
It's been a continuing struggle for Montgomery County, and we have fought and fought successfully over the past couple of decades to increase school construction funding for Montgomery County. We get a greater share than most of the other jurisdictions because we have grown faster, but we're not getting there as fast as we need to.
Doug Duncan is running for county executive, and he's complained that Ike Leggett has not been aggressive enough. Ike Leggett, of course, disagrees, but people are worried that the money is not coming,
right,
the money you need.
Well, I think the County Executive Leggett has done a good job. The legislation got caught up in a crossfire on the last night of the session, disputes over other bills and some personal stuff, perhaps, and it went down. But while I will not be in the Senate next year, I know that the Montgomery County Senate and House delegations will be fighting to ensure that the county gets the school construction money that it needs.
Where were you on the House of Cards? Fun.
I was a skeptic. I supported.
We should say the production company for House of Cards is looking for even greater
tax break than it currently gets, and that did not pass.
I'm not a big fan of throwing money at corporations to keep them in the state. This one looked like it was worth an investment of something. I think what they were asking for was way out of line with the economic benefits that the state is likely to realize from it. On the other hand, we don't want to suffer a blow in public relations or in our appearance to the business community by letting them pack up and leave. So,
but there was a great deal of talk about the amount of jobs these companies provide and how many more jobs they'd be able to provide. And people who oppose giving them greater tax breaks say the county could be spending its tax dollars to create those jobs themselves.
Well, that's right. I mean, If you looked purely at how we might maximize the creation of new jobs, I don't think we would be investing it in tax credits for film companies or for filming in Maryland.
On to Jenny in Laurel, Maryland. Jenny, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Jenny Kalmanson. I'm the vice president of the American Humanist Association and a constituent of your friend Jim Rosenfeld. And I want to know where you stand on church-state separation.
Exactly what do you mean by that?
Well, for example, the Carroll County recently had an issue where their county councilor was opening legislative sessions with a very sectarian prayer, which violated, of course, the separation of church and state by establishing a bona fide, very Protestant sectarian religion in her county. And until she was outvoted by the rest of her county council, this was looking like it was going to be heading for court. And something that I would hope Brian Frosch would have fought for the side of separation.
Yeah, absolutely, Jenny. In fact, we had a select committee on prayer in the Maryland Senate a number of years ago, and I was on it. We make sure that the prayers that open our Senate sessions are non-sectarian, and it's an important principle. Everybody has to understand there are people of many faiths that are members of the Senate.
Enough so that you had a select committee on prayer?
This is a huge, that's a big issue. And I'm not sure why every government organization simply doesn't do a moment of silence,
right,
which allows any person to do anything he or she wants, including planning their grocery list if they don't have anything to plan, pray for.
There was an effort to reform Maryland's system for bail hearings in this past session. It fell short. What were those bills designed to do, and where do things go from here?
Well, I think we missed an opportunity there. Our Court of Appeals passed an order that said that we have to provide representation for defendants at two levels of bail review. We're one of the few states in the country that has a system that does it twice. We had an opportunity to reform the system, to streamline it, and to make better decisions. There are risk assessment tools that have been developed. The Arnold Foundation has one that's been tested across 1.5 million cases. And it's a scientific tool that predicts whether somebody is likely to show up for his trial or her trial and or likely to offend if they're released before trial. It predicts better than human beings in most cases. I mean, on average, all systems make mistakes.
I only have about a minute left.
We're not able to get a bill passed this year that would have streamlined our system and put a scientific tool in place, but the governor is headed in that direction.
The SEIU keeps tweeting.
Yes, I got that too.
Let Senator Frosch know of our endorsement. Do you not know?
They did it today. This happened today.
It just happened today, and I'm very proud of it.
But you knew about it.
I got word of it. Yes, I did.
Okay, he's heard about it, SEIU. You can stop tweeting now.
I've got four from it.
No, tweet to everybody.
You got a final question? You got about 40 seconds.
Actually, not one you can answer in that time, but I'm just anxious to see people running for public office appear together so people can get a better understanding
debates.
Of what they're doing.
We like debates.
Okay.
Brian Frosch, he is a member of the Maryland Senate. He's a Democrat from Montgomery County. He's also a Democratic candidate for Attorney General of Maryland. Senator Frosch, thank you for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thanks for having me, Scott Joe. Tom.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers.
Tom. And I'm going downtown to talk to the Downtown Business Improvement Sams.
And we have had some very special visitors today. So Naima, Nazira, and Hassan, thank you all for joining us. Those are my grandchildren. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nahamdi. Coming up Monday on the Kojo Nahamdi Show, In with the Old, one of the world's most complex T-Rex skeletons is headed for Washington. The Smithsonian's Natural History Museum director on the future star of the Dinosaur Hall. Then at 1, Images of War, how our views of war are shaped by cell phone photos, YouTube videos, and photojournalists on the front lines. The Kojo Nahamdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
Today's programs were made possible in...
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Nahamdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button and thanks.